From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, we talk with writer Deva Sobel about the remarkable Marie Curie and the other women scientists she impacted, and her new book, The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science. Then, award-winning journalist Vince Beiser joins the show to discuss the race for critical metals in this electrical digital age, and his new book, Power Metal, The Race for Resources That Will Shape the Future. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, 90 years ago, the world lost the most famous woman in the history of science, Marie Curie. Our next guest highlights Madame Marie Curie's influential career, including being the first woman to ever be awarded a Nobel Prize, and more specifically, the sole Nobel laureate decorated in two separate fields of science, physics in 1903 with her husband Pierre, and chemistry by herself in 1911. Our guest is Pulitzer Prize finalist and best-selling author Deva Sobel, who joins us today to discuss her new book, The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science, in which she shines a spotlight on this very remarkable woman. Deva, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. I know this to be true, and you could probably expand on it. If you are playing a trivia game and you say female scientists, 99% of the people will say Marie Curie, but
I think 100%.
Yeah, probably 100%. Can you expand?
I think if the second question was name another one, there would be a complete block also. I think some people know that she had something to do with radioactivity, that she discovered elements, which was remarkable in itself. In her lifetime, the periodic table of the elements was still a work in progress. And so it was possible to discover new elements. And she showed that radioactivity was one way to do that.
Yes. I want to just mention how you have arranged the book, and you go through the periodic table of the elements, and each chapter has a name of a person who was in the orbit of Marie Curie's life, along with one of the elements in the periodic table. Why did you decide to do it that way? It's very entertaining.
I'm so glad you found that entertaining. I'm really happy with that. It came to me because it allowed all the people to be named. And they're just first names, which shows the closeness of the relationships, how friendly everything was. And elements, some of the elements named are not on the final periodic table that we see today. Things like ionium, which people thought was an element in its own right, but turned out not to be. So that sense of making discoveries, learning the science as it unfolds over the course of her life was something I wanted to bring out. You know you're going to meet somebody by that name in the chapter, but you're not sure why that element is associated with that person or that moment. It's a little game within the book. It's pretty easy to figure out, I think.
There are many things I don't know about the periodic table, so that was enlightening for me. So thank you.
One of the real challenges of this book was looking at the science the way they looked at it. And some of the concepts, some of the terms survive, are still used in current discussion, but they mean different things. And so if you go to learn about, say, atomic weight, you will get the modern understanding of what it is, which includes the understanding of the structure of the atom, which was not at all known at the time she began working. So that sense of mystery, that sense of, well, we're onto something here, but we're not really sure what it is, that was something I wanted to preserve in the telling of the story.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with Deva Sobel. She is the author of the new book, The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science. And Deva, I'm nervous and excited to talk to you because to me, Longitude was one of the best books ever written, and it truly set the standard for what good science writing is with the storytelling and the history and the science. And it really sent me on a path of curiosity about clocks and all things mechanical. So first of all, thank you for that book. I've given away so many copies. I've probably been a big buyer of your copies for the last number of years, but it really is one of the best books I've ever read. So getting back to Marie Curie, why her? There have been so many books written about her. What was it about her story that made you, one of the best science writers of our time, delve into this topic?
Well, first, I just want to say how nice it is that here we are, three women talking about science. And I have become only lately sensitized to the issue of women in science. So you mentioned Longitude. That was about 30 years ago that book came out. And it was followed by books about Galileo and Copernicus and mostly about men. In the course of writing The Glass Universe, which is about the women who worked at the Harvard College Observatory, I discovered something truly awful about myself, which was that I kept being surprised by what those women had achieved. And that reaction, a repeated reaction, made me realize that all these years, I had just been lucky not to face any kind of discrimination. Nobody told me, oh, girls aren't interested in science, or you're not smart enough to do physics, all the things that many girls are told. That hadn't happened to me. And yet, I had not escaped the negative attitudes about women that were just in the air in the 1950s when I was growing up. And I had low expectations about women and real surprise that they could do science. And it was a major embarrassment. And once I recognized it, I started to see it in other women. I had one expert reader on that book who was a professor of astronomy at Harvard. And she had the same experience. And she said that she was, of course, familiar with those names because she was right there at Harvard. But somehow she always thought it was just cute or quaint. She never realized they were actually doing science. So now I've got the religion. And stories about women in science are the only stories that interest me now. And when I heard, and I'll tell you how I heard about it. I read a book some years ago, almost 5 years ago, I guess. It was called Women in Their Element. And it was a collection of essays about various women scientists, probably about 35 of them. And of course, Madame Curie was one of the essays. Her daughter was another. But then there were all these other women whom I hadn't heard of. Over and over in the essay, there was some reference to Madame Curie, how this one had studied under her, and that one had gone to work in her lab. And by the fifth or sixth mention, this was a network. It took very little looking up at the Curie Museum in Paris to find out that there were, in fact, about 45 women who earned their degrees under her mentorship or came to work as a lab technician, not even counting the 150 women she trained during the First World War to be X-ray technicians. So I thought, okay, it's time for a new biography of Madame Curie that focuses on that aspect. And my first thought was to not even treat Madame Curie's biography, because I thought, well, people know about her life. The real interest is these other women. So I'll just tell their stories, but it didn't work. It needed her to be the through line, especially since as women in science, a lot of their stories were very lacking in detail.
Yeah.
That the women disappear. They just fall out of the historical record.
Now, and before we talk about these women, like you said, I Googled a lot of them, or many of them, and seriously, like a half of a Wikipedia page, if that, to, you know, really follow up these amazing women scientists. But before we go there, you talk about how Madame Curie was the first woman to win not one, but two Nobel Prizes. She was the first full professor at the University of Paris. What other firsts can we attribute to her that maybe we aren't familiar with?
First woman to win a Nobel Prize, only person to win in both physics and chemistry, only mother-daughter Nobel Prize winners, first female professor at the University of Paris, first director of a laboratory that she later turned into an institute, a global research institute, first woman, this is a post-mortem achievement, but she's in the Pantheon. Her remains were exhumed and moved to the Pantheon, which is the secular temple to the greatest figures in French history. She was probably the first woman to publish in a couple of the journals. When she was doing her research, things that needed to be reported to the French Academy of Sciences, well, she couldn't do that herself because she was a woman. And she was in line to be the first woman elected to membership, but they did not vote her in, nor was her daughter voted in, although her daughter tried a few times. But the first woman, so I think this is maybe another first, because it was one of her, was a lab technician she had hired toward the end of her life. She hired this young woman who was first in her class in the lab technician school. She came to work at the Radium Institute and she discovered an element, which is wow, not something that happens every day. And so then she was encouraged to go on and get a university education, which she had not been able to afford before that. And she went all the way up and became head of a lab herself, a professor, and the first woman admitted to the French Academy of Sciences.
Incredible.
A lot of firsts, and it works against other women in many ways, because Madame Curie is so fantastic. If you're a young woman aspiring to a career in science, what does she say to you? Is she encouraging or is she intimidating?
Well, one point, and you know, you briefly mentioned that this is that in 1935, her daughter, Irene, is how we would pronounce it, it's different in French, also won the Nobel Prize in chemistry. And so this made, as you said, another first, Marie Curie and her daughter, the only mother-daughter pair to have won a Nobel Prize. So there was something that she did that inspired her daughter and did not intimidate her. And I think this is a really great current message for mothers and daughters today, for mothers to inspire their daughters to do great things.
No, I think it's a very good point. And I think this is a very female story. She was a mother. She had a miscarriage. She had difficulty nursing. She talks about all these things in her correspondence with her family. That was also stunning to me. And the letters back and forth with both her daughters, the relationship that they had is so beautiful. And I was very glad to discover that they all saved each other's letters. And so there are a couple of volumes published, letters from Marie to both, as we say, Irene and Eve. I wanted to say that Marie really was a teacher. She had aspired to be a teacher when she was young. She did teach physics at a girls' academy for teachers. And she was always teaching her own daughters. Whatever they were doing in school, she was also teaching them. And that comes through in the letters.
You briefly mentioned that she was also the first female to become a professor. This was at Sorbonne in Paris. And this was after her husband Pierre's untimely death in 1906. It's very reminiscent of this very new book that was very popular, Lessons in Chemistry, where the female scientist protagonist's husband dies, but she doesn't step into his shoes. And I just mentioned that because I know so many people read that book and saw the series that followed. And so that was amazing. She was able to do that. Why did they choose her?
She was the only person qualified. I'm sure they didn't want to choose her because they'd never had a woman in those kinds of positions before. But the field of science was so new. Who else was there? Mm-hmm. And that's the real sad thing about her not being admitted to the Academy, the French Academy of Sciences, because she was the expert in the field. And she had to have the reports of work done in her lab, whether by her or by the other people there, delivered to the Academy by friends of hers who were members. So it was awkward for them. And some of her colleagues felt it was a national embarrassment that she hadn't been voted in.
Well, you know, a good portion of the book talks about these other female scientists that worked with her in her lab, and she didn't necessarily seek them out. They sought her. And you said at least 45 had gone through her lab. And so we can, you know, I think we can all assume and read about what their working with her did for them. But how did all of these young, brilliant women coming through her lab affect and shape her studies and research as she got older?
I think they really did help her, especially she had one who came from Poland who had become a scientist just because of the stories she heard about the famous Maria Sklodowska-Curie when she was a child. And so they could speak Polish together, speak in dialect. And when Marie's daughter got married or was traveling, this other woman would be the person to walk her home from the laboratory and be her companion, because she never did remarry.
Well, and like we said earlier, so many of these women, they had their time in the scientific sun, if you will, and then they sort of disappeared. But so many of them at the time, they were working as scientists and they got married, and all of a sudden that scientific life ended. And they were then moved on to be wives and mothers. And it's just unfortunate that happened to them. But Madame Curie had such a different support system. I mean, I don't know if enough people, if we give her husband enough credit for, I don't want to say allowing her to keep working, but partnering with his wife. And yeah, talk more about how women's lives ended back then. You could have been a Nobel, you could have been on track to be a Nobel laureate, but you got married and you were expected to just stop.
Yeah, she had tremendous support from her husband. That was that elusive, perfect relationship. But she also had her father-in-law, who came to live with them. His wife had died. So he moved in with them to help take care of the children so Marie could go back to the lab. Today, there was a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. 40% of women scientists in the United States stop working when they have a child. We don't have good childcare. We don't have good support systems. She had all of that, and she had total support of her family of origin. As a child, she was encouraged, she was educated, she had an older brother and older sisters, but all of them were educated. Nobody told her she shouldn't aspire to great things. The opposite.
I was interested in the story about how Marie Curie drove a van that she outfitted with the X-ray machines that she invented into the fields during the Great War, World War I.
You have imagined yourself as a rather petite woman, and the war breaks out, and you say to yourself, well, they're going to need x-rays. This is the first time that that technology is available for battle wounds. So I think I'll get somebody to give me a car, and I'll load it with this equipment, and then I'll just drive it to the front. She didn't even know how to drive. At the beginning, she had someone drive her. And it wasn't only a question of convincing the military authorities that she should be allowed to do this, but the medical doctors themselves, because many of them they'd never seen maybe more than one x-ray in their training. They had no idea what it would do to the kind of surgery they needed to perform. The standard was to just open the wound and poke around looking. And this was an invitation to more pain, morbidity, infection. And sometimes the projectile wasn't found. So with the x-rays, she convinced them almost immediately of their value. And so the next step was to help set up an x-ray unit right there in whatever field hospital she'd arrived at, and then to go on to other places that she had to convince all over again from the beginning. And she did this throughout the war and created this 6-week crash course that any woman could apply for to learn how to use the equipment and enough human anatomy to go out in the field and do that same dangerous vital work. You think of the x-ray exposure that she had in her cotton smock compared to what happens now if you visit the dentist and you get this lid blanket put on you and the dentist walks out of the room to take the x-rays. Yeah, so her terrible health effects, which ultimately took her life, were a combination of x-ray exposure, radioactivity exposure, and possibly tuberculosis exposure, because her mother died of TB when Marie was only 10. And it was rampant. It was just so common at that time. And there are instances where people are infected, but they don't have symptoms, but they can still be contagious.
So Madame Curie died 90 years ago, and now we all understand the hazards of radioactivity exposure. Like you said, the doctors go in the other room, you have the lead blanket. But at the time, did she realize that her discovery was actually what was killing her?
She was able to avoid that recognition for a very long time because her discovery was the cure for cancer for decades. So she had done this tremendous service to the world. But the way that came about was the burns that she would get on her fingers from handling the material. So when she and her husband reported that, doctors immediately thought, well, if it destroys tissue, maybe it'll destroy tumors. And it did. And so that was part of what made her so famous and what got her invited to the United States twice, where she was given a gram of radium each time, a phenomenally costly material. But so many people wanted to help her with this life-saving therapy. And all the time, she's developing early cataracts. She has these burns. And it wasn't until 1924, 25, when the story of the Radium Girls came out, and these young women who were actually working with paint that contained radium, and they died horrible, painful deaths. And of course, she never advocated radium in paint or for any use outside a laboratory or a medical facility. So that was horrible for her to see what this fantastic discovery had wrought.
Well, the book is The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science. It certainly did. Our guest today has been Pulitzer Prize finalist and best-selling author Deva Sobel. Deva, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, look around you. There are electric vehicles everywhere. There's renewable energy and digital technology. And all of that puts us in what is called the electro-digital age. Well, the race to find the critical metals needed for this electro-digital age are all at the center of what our next guest has researched and has written about in a new book called Power Metal. Our guest is award-winning journalist Vince Beiser, and he joins us on Cool Science Radio to tell us all about it. Vince, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Well, as we are becoming more electrified, cities, states, countries have goals of electrification. It all has an end goal that's noble, which is to decrease our dependence on fossil fuels. But electrification, as we know, has a cost as well. Can you just give us a bird's eye view of that cost?
Sure. So basically, I mean, there's this terrible paradox, right? In order to save the environment from climate change, we're switching over to renewables and to electric cars, which is great for the climate, but it's really hard on the earth, on the actual land itself. Why? Because all that stuff, all those electric cars, those wind turbines, those solar panels, and also all the digital gadgets that we all depend on, they're all made out of metals, essentially, right? Lithium, cobalt, nickel, copper. So to build all of the stuff, all of the machinery that we need to pull off the energy transition, we're going to need billions of tons of these metals, more in some cases than we've mined in all of human history. And to get those metals, we're cutting rainforests are being cut to the ground in Indonesia, rivers are being poisoned, children are being put to work in mines, and people are actually getting killed in many places around the world.
It seems like the human toll of mining critical metals is a big one that we as consumers need to be more informed of. The stories are horrible. At the same time, and with any emerging technology, the more we support it, the more the processing and the mining is going to be, there are going to be better and more sustainable ways of doing so. Is that something that you believe?
To a certain extent. I mean, here's the thing. I'm really trying to get across two things with this book. One is, as like you said, you know, this process, even though people call it clean energy or green energy, it comes with these really serious costs. That's number one. We have to be aware of those. Number two is then how can we minimize those? And that's what really the second half of the book is all about. How can we limit that damage? Because there's always some costs. There's always some downsides, right? But there are a lot of things we can do to minimize those costs. And I think, you know, that gets to your question. I mean, part of it, you know, is for sure, as these things progress and as more money goes into them, more research and development dollars and just more experiments, yeah, I do think we're going to find more efficient ways to build these things, alternative chemistries, alternative ways to build electric car batteries, for instance. There's lots of different ways that you can build an electric car batteries using different types of metals, some of which have a bigger environmental footprint than others and so on. So I do think, some of these problems, we will find ways of minimizing the harm. That's the really good news. But it's important to remember, you know, we all kind of want a silver bullet, right? Like we all want to just think like, oh, great, I bought an electric car. Now I'm done. Now I'm on the side of the angels. But no matter what we do, even the best of solutions always come with some kind of downsides, always come with some kind of cost. We have to bear that in mind, even as we work towards bringing those costs down as low as we can.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with award-winning author Vince Beiser. He is the author of the new book, Power Metal, The Race for the Resources That Will Shape the Future. Well, I think you brought up a really interesting point when we started this conversation about how we have all automatically said that EVs are clean and wind turbine, you know, wind power generation is clean. And we all like to think that I'm in my, you know, little electric vehicle and I'm being powered by angels. Well, they're not. And I think that that industry did a really, really good job in convincing us that the end result might be clean. But really, do you think part of this lies in the industry where they have to acknowledge the environmental impacts, or will they ever acknowledge the environmental impacts so that maybe we start to understand the true impact of our purchases?
Yeah, I do. I mean, for sure, that's how EVs are marketed in this country. And actually, I think it's kind of backfiring to a great extent because they've become like kind of a culture war talking point, right? Like in, you know, like, you know, for a lot of folks on the right, it's like, I'll never have an EV because that's what the liberals do, which is, it's just not how anybody should be thinking. And it's really not how people think about them in most of the rest of the world. But that said, yeah, the manufacturers, car makers and battery makers, they are certainly aware of all these issues. And they're, you know, if for no other reason than it's gotten them a lot of bad press over the years, especially the issue of child mining in Congo, right? That's, if you've heard about anything around these issues, that's probably the one. And that looks really bad because it is really bad. So there is a big push on, there's first of all, there's a lot of lip service coming from all of these, everybody from the miners to the manufacturers, to the car makers themselves. They're talking more about this stuff. And they are, you know, to be fair, they are doing some things. They are making some moves to make their supply chains more sustainable, more equitable. It's really tough though. Like it's really, really tough to clean up a lot of these supply chains. Like if we're talking about cobalt, 70% of all the world's cobalt comes from one country, from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that's where you have this huge child mining problem. So there, you know, there are some mines in Congo that don't use child labor. There are some that do. But by the time, you know, all that cobalt gets sold to middlemen who sell it to somebody else, sell it to somebody else. By the time it makes its way to a smelter to get actually turned into pure cobalt for a battery, who knows how much of it came from which mine? It's really, really hard to track these things. You know, a lot of folks, a lot of companies are starting to say that they are doing that. Like Apple, for instance, is making a lot of noise saying that, oh, they use all these third-party audits and they're sure that their supply chains are clean and so on. It's really like, it's really almost impossible to say that.
Well, one of the things you talk about in this book is that, you know, here in America, you're in Canada, at least in America, it's really easy for us to not see the environmental impacts because this is happening in foreign countries that don't have the environmental regulations that allow the rainforest to be cut down, that allow this horrible child labor. And so we just buy our clean, shiny new car or a new clean, shiny new phone and drive around not understanding. But it seems like every time I've spoken to somebody that I say, you know, we should have this kind of extraction here, they just go up in arms because, oh, can't be in my backyard. I guess it's easier for us to just disregard it. But how could it change the supply chain, if you will, if we actually had it in our backyard?
Yeah, well, I mean, this sounds super counterintuitive to anybody who's environmentally minded, but I totally agree with you, Katie. I mean, we really, if you're concerned about these issues, one of the things we should do is really think about allowing more mining back in the United States. I mean, 100 years ago, the US was probably the world's number one mining power. We supplied most of the world's copper, lots of other metals. But basically what happened is, you know, starting around the 60s and 70s with the environmental movement and all the rest of it, we didn't want that stuff in our backyard anymore, right? We didn't want to deal with the pollution. And so just like with most of our heavy industries, steel making and stuff like that, we're perfectly happy to just let it go overseas, let China do it, let Indonesia do it. They'll handle the mess. We'll just buy their products. And the result is, you know, it's still happening, right? All that, you know, all the damage is still being done. It's just being done somewhere else. Whereas, you know, in this country, there's still lots of these critical metals available. And if they are mined here, it's not pretty, it's not nice for sure, but it is done to a higher environmental standard, higher labor standards, all that. So that's one reason. The second reason is this, and this is one that really, that sort of got buy-in from kind of across the aisle, is that in offshoring all this stuff, we have allowed China to take a completely dominant position in the supply chains of every single one of these metals that we're talking about. Not only the metals, but the products that they're used for. So China controls, to one extent or another, the mining of cobalt, lithium, nickel, copper, almost everything we're talking about. They also, wherever those metals are dug up around the world, they go to China to be refined, or the majority of them get shipped over to China to be refined. Even a lot of stuff we mine here in the United States, we don't have the refining capacity. We have to send it to China. And then those refined metals, Chinese companies take those metals and turn them into most of the world's wind turbines, solar panels, electric cars, and the lithium ion batteries that are in all of our electronics. So what that means is that gives China a huge economic clout and also really serious geopolitical leverage, which is really a concern because they've shown they're not afraid to use it. So back in 2010, China and Japan got into a diplomatic dispute over this maritime issue. And to punish Japan, China cut off supply of what are called rare earth metals. This is a group of these weird, obscure metals that are super important for consumer electronics. And China at that time controlled 90% of the world's supply. Well, Japan has a huge consumer electronics industry, of course, and all of a sudden they were told, oh, no more materials for your consumer electronics. It sent shockwaves around the world, and it really made policymakers in the US and corporate executives all over the West really kind of sit up and start to notice, like, holy smokes, we have got to get a supply chain going that is not dependent on China, because otherwise we're in serious trouble. And we're really, you know, the United States has been trying to develop more of a supply chain for national security reasons, basically, but it's still very early days in that effort.
Vince, I'm wondering if you can address the supply chain and the difference between getting these critical metals from China, for example, and our dependence on foreign fossil fuels, foreign oil. I mean, there's a lot more oil, there's a lot more drilling going on in this country than there is mining for these critical elements. So, you know, if you're adding apples to apples, like, how does it compare? Are we ultimately better off with fossil fuels?
Short answer, no. So, you know, the number one threat that we face, the biggest danger of all, is climate change, right? That is a global issue. It's already hitting hard. That's, you know, that's a really, you know, almost existential threat that we face. And that climate change is caused by burning of fossil fuels. We have got to stop doing that. So even if, you know, with all the problems that we're talking about, you know, they're serious and they're severe and they add up to a lot, but they add up to less in aggregate than the threat posed by climate change. So this is the conundrum, right? This is the paradox, is that we have to switch over to renewables, but in the process, we may end up swapping one set of problems for another. Mm-hmm. But they will, even in the worst case, they would be a smaller set of problems than the problem set of climate change, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I feel like people who are considering purchasing an electric vehicle or own them, that it was maybe 5 or 10 years ago that they thought it was doing something great for the environment. I think there's been enough awareness created by people like you who are trying to spread this word that people know, and they're making the choice for whatever reason. I have a friend who has a Tesla who says, oh yeah, I'm not under any illusion that this is clean energy, but I really like the way it drives and I really like that torque that an EV gives. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the next step for us in creating this awareness? It's going to take a lot of mining here in this country. And as much as we don't like those open pit copper mines out in the Salt Lake Valley or, you know, in Montana, that it's going to take this kind of thing, or is it?
So two things about that. One is, I just had a thought when you were talking about fossil fuels versus metal mining. One thing that's important to think about is, fossil fuel extraction the actual process of doing it is not that, doesn't make that, doesn't do that much environmental harm. Like if you go out to a fracking field in North Dakota where I've been, you would barely even know that you're there, that there's this gigantic industrial process going on. It's just like a well and some pipes connected to it. Everything, you know, it's all being sucked up from underground and then the oil gets run out through pipes. And it doesn't really look like that big a deal. It doesn't really disturb that much land, relatively speaking. Whereas you go to a big copper mine and it's like miles and miles of devastation and it's a pit big enough to, you know, drop the Empire State Building into, literally. Like, so it's much more, metal mining looks much worse. It does sort of more damage in the extraction, but fossil fuels create, you know, where they are really dangerous is when you burn them. It's at the other end when we actually consume them. Whereas the batteries, the electric cars and the rest of it that we're using those metals for, they have, you know, there's almost no pollution that comes out at the other end. So I think that's one way in which sort of, you know, fossil fuel extraction is kind of an easier sell in a way, because people don't see it happening, that the harms are really kind of invisible in a way. That said, how can we raise awareness? Right. So I think, you know, we need to keep, to let people know about these harms for sure. But I really think, you know, the number one thing that we can do as individuals, as consumers, to, you know, to help lower the damage that we're doing is one that sounds like a hard sell, but I don't actually think should be. And it's this: don't buy a car at all, not even an electric one. Right now, I'm not saying nobody should own a car. I'm not saying you're a terrible person if you own a car. I own a car, right? If you need a car, of course, have a car. But here's the thing. Most Americans, like most people everywhere in the world, now live in cities. We live in places that are dense, where we don't necessarily need, if that city is designed well, you don't necessarily need a car to get around. Like a real life example, I used to live in Los Angeles for many years with my wife and our two kids. And there, of course, we had two cars, right? We needed them to get everywhere, to work, school, all the rest of it. We moved back to my hometown of Vancouver, Canada, a few years ago, and immediately we got rid of one of those cars. Why? Because Vancouver, just in the last 20 years or so, has put a lot of effort into building up bicycle lanes, right? So there's safe, protected networks of bike lanes where you can get pretty much everywhere. There's a decent public transit system. There's walkable neighborhoods. All this is like the result of deliberate planning. And the result is we don't need that second car anymore. And I got to tell you, getting rid of that car is a huge quality of life upgrade for me, right? The amount, I have so much less stress. I don't have to worry about parking it, paying for it, insuring it, maintaining it, fixing it. You know, downgrading my sort of material standard of living was actually a boost in the quality of my life. And if we can replicate that kind of thing on a big scale, if we can just bring down the number of cars on the road by 10 or 20%, that will take a huge bite out of the amount of energy that we need and the amount of metals that we need to mine.
Vince, one of the things that's great about your book is it's not just about the negative aspects of mining and making these batteries, but it's also what you called the reverse supply chain, which is really about recycling and reusing these materials. Well, in doing some research today, I was reading that they estimate there's over 1 billion gas-powered vehicles on this planet. 1 billion. As we shift to electronic vehicles, it's not like you can just modify the existing vehicle. It's all about purchasing a new vehicle. So as we do this, I'm just envisioning massive piles and junkyards of old vehicles. So that creates its own challenge as well. What can be done with these old vehicles as we transition to electric or get rid of our vehicle?
So the good news is car recycling, conventional gas-powered car recycling, there's a pretty efficient ecosystem around that, at least in Western countries. I'm not so sure about in the developing world. But basically, we have, you know, scrapyards have been recycling these things for a long time. It actually was a huge problem in the 1960s. So many people were just dumping their cars, you know, by the side of the road, and it was actually considered one of the major environmental issues, all these junked cars lying around everywhere. But what happened was a new, this entrepreneur in the scrap business came up with these small, affordable shredders where, like, you know, kind of your local scrapyard could afford to buy this thing and take an old car and tear it down to pieces in an affordable way, in a profitable way, so that they could then sell those metals. So you notice you don't see a lot of junk cars lying around in the US anymore because they're valuable, because people can make money off of recycling them. And that's really what it takes to get recycling going, is it's got to become profitable. Now, that didn't happen all by itself. That also happened because of government incentives, because government stepped in and sort of pushed that industry along. So that's definitely going to be necessary when we're talking about recycling the materials that we need, these metals that we need for the energy transition. When we're talking about recycling lithium ion batteries, electric car batteries, all that stuff, it's not profitable at this point. The free market is not going to take care of it all on its own, but it can be made profitable with, you know, government subsidies, tax credits, incentives, all that kind of stuff. And by the way, why not? We do that. We subsidize all kinds of other industries. We subsidize the hell out of the oil and gas industry. You know, we subsidize ethanol production. You know, when we decide that there's an industry that's really important for our well-being, we pour money into it. When we needed a COVID vaccine, we put hundreds of billions of dollars into it, no questions asked. But we really do need more recycling. And, you know, so let's send a few billion government dollars that way. It's a good idea.
And we like to sit and badmouth the batteries in electric vehicles and only complain about the mineral use for electric vehicles, but it's also wind turbines. It's also our cell phones. It's our computers. And as we buy more and more of these electronics, we're culpable across all levels. So what are the other big players in this mineral extraction and environmental degradation, if you will, when it comes to the electro-digital age?
Yeah, so I call it that because, you know, the idea of renewable energy is it's all electricity, right? We're moving towards a future where everything's going to be run on renewably generated electricity. And we are moving in that direction, I think, much faster than most people realize. Not so much in the US. We are really behind most of the rest of the developed world on this front. But in China, man, like, most new vehicles being sold in China now are electric cars. The other piece of it is the digital piece, right? And that is, you know, all of our digital gadgets, this laptop that I'm talking to you on, you know, the headphones that I see in your ears, right? All of the machinery that makes our internet-enabled life possible. Those things all need basically the same basket of metals that renewable energy does. Cobalt, lithium, nickel, copper, these rare earth metals that I talked about, all that stuff is also in our consumer electronics. So that's part of the demand. So all those things are, you know, all of our electronics are also contributing to the problems of extraction. And it's even worse when we get to the recycling piece of it, because most of that stuff just doesn't even get recycled in this country. Only one out of every six cell phones gets recycled in the US. Right. And that's a really big problem. It's a big problem because, you know, that stuff ends up, you know, we all have junk drawers that are full of old cables and chargers that don't work anymore. And what do you do with that stuff? And often people just end up throwing them in the trash, which is a big problem because they're full of toxic chemicals that can leach into the land, into the groundwater. Those batteries can burst into flames, which is happening a lot. And also, it's just a huge waste. It's estimated we throw out about $60 billion worth of critical metals every single year, just in our e-waste, which is insane, right? So we really need to build up the ability, the capacity. We need to make it easier for folks to recycle those things, which, by the way, they do a much better job of in many developing countries, basically because, you know, there's lots more people who are willing to work for the, you know, $1 or $2 worth of metal that you might find in an old laptop. We don't have that here, again, because it's just not profitable here. But it could be made profitable. That's where we need the government to step in and, you know, sort of goose the industry along.
Yeah, it's funny. As you said that, Vince, I was thinking about how in Cuba, they've been recycling those same cars from the 1950s mm-hmm. because of the embargo. And yet, if you look at the carbon footprint of, you know, one of those big old 1950s Chevrolets, it's probably way less than we would ever get with, you know, an EV. And so again, yeah, in the developing world, reusing, upcycling, you know, all of that stuff that happens, that we are kind of in this market where we just will throw something away. So it's a really interesting awareness that you bring in your book, Power Metal. In the book, do you get to talking about the individual metals? I mean, we know, like you keep mentioning lithium, nickel, cobalt, and copper. We know a lot about copper because we've been mining it here, but do you address those individual metals so we know where maybe there are stores of cobalt that have not yet been discovered that are away from the Congo?
Sure. Yeah, there definitely are. I mean, there's the first half of the book, there's about four or five chapters that are focused on specific metals, basically all those ones you just listed. There are others that matter to the energy transition, but those are kind of the top of mind one. But yeah, absolutely. There's more of these metals in many places. Part of the challenge, we know that for sure, but part of the challenge is finding where exactly. So there is a huge, this global scramble that's going on right now of companies and national governments looking for new sources of all these metals and finding them in some places, right? Zambia, they're opening up big new mines in Zambia for copper. And in the US, we know that we have a lot of this stuff. You know, we've got there's a huge copper mine that they've been trying to open up in Arizona for a long time. They're trying to reopen. By the way, all these metals used to be mined on a big scale in the United States, all of them. So the world's number one source of lithium used to be North Carolina. They're trying to reopen those mines there. We used to produce most of the world's cobalt. We don't think we produce any of it anymore, but there's folks trying to reopen some of those cobalt mines or dig new ones in areas where we know there's cobalt. But of course, you know, trying to open a mine in the United States in 2024 is really hard because nobody wants it there. No matter where you want to open a mine, you know, environmental activists, indigenous people living nearby, local communities nearby, everybody will turn out to fight it, which is totally understandable, right? The history of mining in this country is terrible, absolutely terrible. And I certainly don't blame anybody who doesn't want one of those in their backyard. But the problem is all of that opposition, the downside, because again, everything has a cost, right? Even the like fight to preserve, you know, a natural area in your state, if you're trying to fight against a copper mine, because it's going to, you know, harm the desert or whatever, the cost to that is that it slows down the energy transition. It means that at the moment, there isn't enough copper coming online to meet the projected demand, which might mean that in a few years, you know, we just won't have enough of these metals to build all the electric cars and everything else that we need, which could slow down the energy transition. So again, I mean, there's no easy answers, right? Everything comes with a cost. I'm not saying, you know, suck it up, people of Utah or Arizona or whatever, and go ahead and let them strip mine your favorite national forest. You know, each one is has its own pluses and minuses, but we do have to accept more mining is definitely going to be required. And really some of it should happen in the US and Canada where I live.
Again, the book is Power Metal, and our guest is award-winning journalist Vince Speiser. Vince, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It was really fun.
Thanks for tuning into Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. If you have ideas for a future show, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And if you like today's episode, rate us, leave us a comment, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.